Okay, so welcome. I'm very happy to see so many familiar and unfamiliar faces here. Going to talk about the question, which law applies to financial torts? And I'm going to do this in English, which may seem a little bit strange to you, since we are basically all speaking German, but there are two good reasons to do that. One is the slides are in English, and I have prepared them in English. The second is it's a topic that relates to European law and the European Union, and I'm going to develop a proposal that is done for the European Union and should apply on the European Union level, and the discussion on these topics is going on basically in English. So you will hardly have any impact if you do that in German. So that's why I tried in English. And I hope you enjoy that and you take this as an opportunity to also try to figure out the terms in English, the English terminology, and you're not too shy to ask questions at the end. You can do that, of course, in German or English as you like. So, what am I going to do? I'm going to present you first how the current conflicts laws applies to financial torts. So what is the state of the affairs right now? Then I'm going to show you that this has very grave economic consequences, and I'm going to analyze some escape routes that have been suggested in the literature, how we can get out of this situation. Then, briefly, I will say that there is a need for reforming the so-called Rome II regulation, and I will propose a new rule. What are we talking about? We are talking about financial torts. Financial torts is a very, very big category. But that is usually so in private international law, where we determine the applicable law. We usually use broad categories like marriage, contract, property, because we want to determine which law applies to these legal relationships or situations. And if we would do that in a too limited way, then we risk of that some of the most important or more or less important actual phenomena escape the application of the rule. So the category has to be broad as is possible. And I suggest using this category financial tort. It encompasses, for instance, it encompasses above all situations in which there is private liability. Private liability for the violation of capital market regulation. There is an interesting interconnection here between public and private law. You become civilly liable because you violate actually public law. Okay? Capital market regulation is in the first place public law, I'm afraid to admit, and the civil law liability attaches to that. So in which cases can you become civilly liable for violating capital market law? For instance, if you issue a false prospectus. If I am, for instance, I'm selling shares or bonds, I'm a company like Daimler, I'm selling shares, and I'm putting wrong information into the prospectus. I need, for regulatory reasons, every share issue, every bond issue has to be accompanied by a prospectus that explains something about the financial instrument and about the issuer. And if there are wrong information if there is wrong information in this prospectus, I can become civilly liable. The most famous case recently has been the one of Deutsche Telekom, which has been brought to an end after more than 10 years of litigation. This was a typical case of prospectus liability, in which, by the way, Deutsche Telekom was largely coming out without any liability. Then insider trading, everybody more or less has an idea. The question, of course, is not so much who is liable, that's the insider, but to whom, who's actually the damaged party. But there is some civil liability in many states. And the question I'm talking about is, which law do we apply to this insider liability if the inside information, for instance, has been used in France, but parties are damaged in Germany, the US, Italy, and so on. Market manipulation, if I am trying to influence somehow the price of the share illegally, I might become civilly liable. Merger offers for mergers and acquisition, again, public law, regulatory law provides some conditions that you have to fulfill in order to do such an offer. Or shareholder transparency, another example. If you buy more than 3% of a company, then you have to declare publicly that you hold more than 3%. Then again, if you step over a threshold of 5%, 10%, and so on. And if you don't do that, you might be liable. Okay, this is capital market law. And the interesting question is, which law governs those financial torts? And it's a question that's that has an increasing importance if you look at the globalization of financial markets, the increasing interconnectedness. More and more people are buying in foreign markets, and if there is insider trading on those markets, then people all over the world will be affected. And the question is simply, whose law will apply to this civil liability? Well, in Europe, the state of affairs currently is like this. We have the so-called Rome II regulation. Anybody has heard of it so far? Rome I and Rome II? You have probably heard about it, but not in depth, or you don't really have an idea about what is in this regulation. Mr. Ducek, who's also here today, and me, we're about to publish two articles even on that in Juristische Schulung, forthcoming. So that will explain everything about the Rome II regulation. But basically, it's the regulation that tells us which law applies in civil and commercial matters for non-contractual liability. So for all those cases that you have heard about in your law studies, your legal studies, where there is no previous contact between the tortfeasor and the victim, between the two parties, but nevertheless, they have especially no contractual relationship, but nevertheless, there is a claim of one against the other party, for instance, because of unjust enrichment. Negotiorum gestio is what we would call Geschäftsführung ohne Auftrag, or torts, typically torts. So this is the law that will be applied by tribunals all over the European Union, except Denmark. We always have to make this exception because Denmark does not take part in this cooperation in civil matters. So all tribunals in European member states, in European Union member state except those of Denmark, will apply the Rome II regulation when they want to know which law applies to non-contractual liability. There are some exceptions. I'm skipping over this because they don't apply. You could think about maybe we are talking here about something similar to negotiable instruments, which are not covered by the Rome II regulation, but actually we don't. And it's also not a matter of company law, it's capital market law. So clearly, the Rome II regulation applies. Now, I don't want it to become too technical, but just briefly to tell you that the Rome II regulation contains also a rule about the law that applies to culpa in contrahendo, so to pre-contractual liability, which should surprise you as good German law students and good German lawyers, because in Germany we think of CIC as being contractual liability. But actually, the European regulation says, no, it's pre-contractual, so non-contractual liability. There is not yet a contract. And we could think about whether this rule, Article 12, which relates to culpa in contrahendo, applies to financial torts. But Article 12 says that it wants to be applied only to dealings prior to the conclusion of a contract. And precisely in the cases that I've given you, an insider does a tort, or somebody manipulates the market and somebody else gets damaged, there is no dealing between the parties. So clearly, Article 12 is not applicable, and only Article 4 remains. Article 4 is the basic provision, the general clause of the Rome II regulation, and Article 4 says the law that applies to liability for tortious liability, is the law of the country in which the damage occurs. So that's something that you can take home from today. If there is a tort, the law that applies will always be the place, the law of the place in which the damage occurred. Now, if you think about my example of false prospectuses or also insider trading, it seems quite difficult to say at which place actually, in which state actually, a damage occurs, right? Because this is what we have in those cases is so-called economic loss. It's not a loss to a it's not a damage that is done to a physical object, to a person or a house or mobile equipment, something like that. It's rather a damage that is calculated, that you feel in your personal wealth, but which you cannot situate really. There are two opinions that have been suggested how you localize the place of damage in these kinds of cases where you actually don't have a physical damage. And the first opinion developed in Germany a couple of years ago is that we say, well, the damage that is done to my patrimony, to my wealth, to my personal wealth, to all that belongs to me, is felt by me at the place of my habitual residence. Because basically that's where I'm living, where I'm spending the money. That's where I feel the loss. The case law of the European Court of Justice goes in another direction. The European Court of Justice rather asks where the damaged asset is situated. So we have to find a specific asset of your patrimony, of your wealth that has been damaged, and then we have to find out where this asset is located. And for instance, if you're losing money that you had in your bank account because you have paid financial instruments, you have paid shares from there, then we localize your bank account at the place of the branch of the bank, and then the law of this country applies. So far, so unclear? Clear? Okay. No, there's a question, Mr. Berg.
Is the bank account located?
As I said, bank account's location is identical to the place of the branch of the bank, the branch or subsidiary of the bank. So it's kind of legal fiction, if you want. We don't actually look where is the money, because the money is anyway only in an account, But it's where your account is administered, where your account is held, and that's in the branch. So actually, I have my money, so to speak, in, well, I don't tell you which bank, in a bank in Halle, and then it would be presumed that if I paid for shares that I've bought from here, from this bank account, then it's German law that would apply because the bank account is situated in Germany. Yes, Jasper. Yes. Yes.
Then if there is any talk between me and the Spanish investor.
Yes.
The law determining this law is the Luxembourg law.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have
all. Makes sense at all.
No, it makes no sense at all, and that's precisely why I'm proposing to amend this, simply reform this. It makes no sense. Also from an economic perspective, because you have to imagine that not only it might be a pure coincidence where I have my bank account, but it might also be a pure coincidence who is buying the instruments. Okay, let's say I'm an issuer, or I'm Daimler, and I'm issuing shares, and I'm issuing them in Germany, and then somebody from Mongolia buys them on the secondary market. I cannot prohibit this person, I cannot stop him from buying this, even if it's in Germany, because anybody could buy this. And then later, somebody finds there was a wrong information in your prospectus, I would be, as an issuer, I would be liable under the law of Mongolia. At the same time, I would be liable under the law of Germany, under the law of Poland, under Russian law, and so on, of all the states where the investors are sitting. So we have a multitude of different laws that will apply. But there was a question here.
Yeah, I just have a question. What would happen if damages occur in multiple places?
Yeah, so you have what's called also the mosaic theory. You would have to apply to the liability towards those investors that are in Mongolia, you would have to apply Mongolian law. To those that are in Poland, you would have to apply Polish law, and so on. And it's not only its own very complicated, it's a kind of atomization of the applicable law, but it's also completely unpredictable for the tortfeasor. Any legal system of the world could potentially apply to liability, yeah?
Yes, it's the law that applies only the law determining the amount, the fraud amount,
yeah.
The damages,
yeah.
Or is it also the consumer protection law that would apply determining whether or not in court has occurred in the first place? So in the end, if I have to issue prospectus, then I have to apply the consumer laws of all legal systems will apply to us potentially.
Excellent question, excellent question. Really strong performance by Jasper today, and I wonder why he is in public law and not doing private international law. Maybe he should switch. That's exactly also the second key question. It's really a key question. How we understand liability. If we basically, the Rome II regulation suggests to apply to everything. The question of the amount of liability, the person that is liable, and so on, the standard of liability, but also the question whether there was a tort in the first place. So whether there was insider trading, market manipulation, and so on, and or a false prospectus. And if you really think that through, if you follow this approach down to the end, then you would indeed come up with the result that in order to avoid prospectus liability, I have to obey all the different laws of the world. It makes no sense whatsoever. There's one article, Article 17. I will come to that later if we have enough time. that allows a little bit to improve this solution and say, because Article 17 says, I can take into account, or the judge can take into account for assessing the liability, the conduct rules of the place where the person acted. Okay, that helps to a certain extent, but it also is not really viable for financial torts, because where I'm acting is often not so important. I might give inside information about Daimler while I'm on holiday in Malta, right? And it's rather German law than Maltese law that should apply, because it's related to the German market. So everything, basically, these you have to imagine that when the Rome II regulation was adopted, what they had in mind is the standard tort, the standard traffic accident. And for this kind of liability, it works very well. But they phrased the regulation so broad that it covers any kind of non-contractual obligation. And in this category also belongs liability for financial torts. And there is no proper conflict rule for that. Well, this has a certain number of very remarkable consequences from an economic perspective. First of all, and that's my personal estimate, okay? I'm not an economist, might be wrong, but the logical conclusion would be, the logical reaction for some issuer who understands the system would be that he says, well, if I'm placing instruments on the market, I have to be more careful. My liability might be much higher, much more different than I have so far expected, and I need to ask for more reward, simply, for doing this transaction, if I'm incurring such a high liability. The second effect might be that the issuer says, okay, I'm not placing any instruments at all, because I could basically go bankrupt under the investment law of Mongolia, right? The third consequence is more interesting. Especially in the US, there are some authors who claim that the private liability has a certain public function. Okay? Private liability is there to deter you from acting in a certain way. So we are attaching private liability, for instance, to violations of competition law in order to avoid that people enter into trusts and cartels. And the same applies to financial law. We attach liability to financial torts in order to deter people from doing insider trading, market manipulation, or giving false prospectuses. Now, if we think about which state determines here under the Rome II regulation, which state determines the liability, it is not the state of the market where something happens, but it's rather the state of the investor's domicile or habitual residence. And this is this takes from the state of the market, it deprives the state of the market from the possibility of to enforce its own private liability, its own regulation through litigation, its own private rules on a liability for financial torts. And the idea of regulating through litigation, of deterring people by private law consequences, no longer works. Is that clear? Okay. Then there is also a certain discrimination of investors from states with lower level of protection. So for instance, I had a very interesting discussion about that. Problem of this topic, by the way, is it's on the interface between capital market law and private international law. So you have to discuss this with mostly with people who are doing conflict of laws and that are not so much acquainted with the realities of capital markets. So one argument was that I had to discuss was if I'm going to New York Stock Exchange, and I'm buying something, then the argument was, why should I not be protected by German law? I said, well, German law is is less strict in protecting the investor. So you get a much higher, you would get a much higher liability and a much higher claim against the issuer if New York state law would apply or federal US securities law would apply. And I don't see why you would not have this benefit simply because of the fact that you're a German resident. Why shouldn't you be able to also invoke the protections of the federal securities laws of the United States if you choose to invest on the American market? At the same time, there might be some investors who come from these high-level protection, I call them high-level protection states, for instance from the US, and they have invested in Germany. Now, if their law would apply, they would be able to bring really huge claims against the German companies while the German investors don't. And these American investors, in that sense, then would take away all the funds of the company for themselves, and the remainder is simply to share for the poor Europeans who don't have such a high protection. Okay, the value of the company is diminished by those claims, and if some of the investors take out more than the others, then clearly the others are left behind. Moreover, a standard argument that is made in favor of applying the law of the investor, of the law of the habitual residence of the investor, is to say, well, it protects its investor protection. It's good for the investor. He knows his national law. That's how he lives anyway. If it's a little bit less than American law, okay, but that's, he's accustomed to his own law. In the end, the world is like this. I would say that the customer also loses out in this process, because if the price of financial products rises due to this insecurity as to the applicable law, then you will have less opportunities to invest. People will not offer you so many securities, so many financial instruments to invest in. And then finally, if a multitude of different laws apply, then usually class actions will not be possible. Class actions are key in investor protection because only if I can bring my claim against Deutsche Telekom together with other investors, then it makes sense for me to bring this claim. Most investors would not bring the claim individually. So class action collective redress, as it is called, is very essential for the enforcement of capital market law. And the fact of the matter is class actions are only possible if the same law applies to the claims of all investors. Because especially American courts usually refuse to accept class actions when different laws apply to different claims, because then there are no longer identical or similar questions of law and fact to be decided if different laws apply. So it makes no sense to bring this in a class action. And if this conflict rule that we have here, if it leads to the application of a number of different laws, then it somehow inhibits class actions and collective redress. Now, there are a number of escape routes that have been suggested in the literature, and what I will do now is I will just skip over them, because it seems to me that they are too technical, and you really don't need to know about them in order to understand the argument. If you are interested in that, I am about to publish, or in September, two articles on this will be published by me, one in Germany in IPRAX, and one in France in the Revue Critique, Le Droit International Privé. That's the longer one. And so if you're really, really keen on this topic and interested in this topic, then you can look up those articles in order to know how I deal with or why I don't find the suggested escape routes convincing. And I'm coming to the need for a new rule. I think I have already demonstrated enough that we need indeed a new rule. And because we simply have no specialized conflicts rule in Europe that would fit financial markets. And just to illustrate this, the conflict rules that apply, for instance, in the United States or in Switzerland are very different. They are not connected at all to the residence of the investor, but to other points, which I took as an inspiration for suggesting a new rule. This new rule actually, and I'm skipping also over this, has indeed been adopted by a body called the German Council on Private International Law, Deutscher Rat für Internationales Privatrecht. And this is I wouldn't say obscure body, but it's a kind of secret body because they don't have a website. I don't even actually know who are all the members of them. It's kind of kept secret, but it's largely, you could describe it as being a body of experts, professors in private international law that give advice to the German Federal Ministry of Justice. Okay. Conflict of law is such a specialized area and also a highly theoretical area that the Ministry of Justice prefers to take advice by a certain group of experts. In Germany, I'm not a member of this council, but they invited me to suggest a resolution or to suggest some reform of the Rome II regulation. And after 2 days of discussion, at which Mr. Rehan was there, and he had to write a very long protocol of about 50 pages. They really want protocols to write down, to know afterwards every word that has been spoken. We came up with a resolution that basically, Mr. Rehan, looks similar to what I suggested, although it's not 100%. You never win 100%, but it's basically what I suggested. And the idea is to introduce a new article in the Rome II regulation, which would be called Illicit Acts on Financial Markets. And I don't want to go into too much detail so that we can have also a short discussion. I'm just presenting the general rules that we have there, the most general rules in Article 1. And maybe this does not even come as a surprise anymore to you, that it looks quite different from Article 4. The place where the damage occurred no longer matters. What matters now is the law of the country where the financial instrument concerned is admitted for trading. Okay. So we apply the law, each and every instrument is traded somewhere, offered somewhere, and regulated markets, of which this article speaks are a part of stock exchanges. Stock exchanges in Europe usually have two parts, so-called regulated market and an open market. And if the financial instrument is admitted to trading on a regulated market, like for instance the shares of Volkswagen, Bayer, and so on, admitted to trading at the Frankfurt Stock Exchange on the in the so-called prime standard, that's the regulated market in Frankfurt, then any tort that is related to those shares would be submitted to German law. Yes? Well, if he would not be already working at your place, I would immediately hire him. Exactly. That's why we need, I'm just skipping over this, we need a second rule for multiple listings, of course. There are shares that are listed in more than one country, traded in more than one country, and then we need a second rule for that particular conflict, and in this case the idea is to apply the place or the law of the country in which a financial instrument has been acquired or sold. Okay. Now you could of course say it's very difficult to know where it is acquired or sold, especially in this kind of internet trading that we have and so on, but actually there is no way out of this. Once that you have multiple listings, you cannot use this listing anymore as a connecting factor, then, well, we didn't find any other solution than to refer to the place, the country in which it was sold. This is also true if the instrument is traded outside of a regulated market. Okay, there are some instruments that are not traded in Frankfurt, but that are traded, for instance, over the counter, which you buy, well, in a bank or so. You're going to a bank and you say, I want shares of Halloren AG. Okay, you don't buy them, at least not that I know of, that they are listed on an exchange. You buy them via an intermediary on the so-called over-the-counter, in the over-the-counter trade, that means individually. And in this case, the rule also refers to the law of the country where the instrument has been acquired or sold, and there is an additional exception, because if you think about, once again, about my example with Mongolian law, if somebody happens to buy shares of Halloren in a bank in Mongolia, then we don't want Halloren to be liable under the law of Mongolia, so there is a clause here that says it must be reasonable for the issuer to foresee that this share could have been sold in Mongolia, and otherwise this rule does not apply. Now, before Jasper again asks me what happens if I can't foresee this law, I'm already showing him that there is we have also a rule for that. I'm skipping over this. Where the law applicable cannot be determined pursuant to paragraph 1, the non-contractual obligation shall be governed by the law of the country with which it is most closely connected. That's, of course, a catch-all clause. It doesn't say really which law we apply. It just says, judge, please determine which law should apply. But it's standard language in private international law, and you also find it in numerous places of the regulation. And there are, in total, we have 6 paragraphs that we have suggested. But I would say the basic one is paragraph 1. The other ones are somehow folkloristic, what you usually do in private international law and what you add, and it's not really essential. The essential change, I'm a little bit hesitant to say groundbreaking change, but the basic change is, the fundamental change is from the law of the place where the damage occurs to the law of the market. And that's the suggestion. What will now happen if Mr. Wagner from the Ministry of Justice holds true to his promise? He will suggest such a rule in Brussels, and then all the others will start debating this rule and complaining about this rule. I'm pretty sure that there will be a lot of obstacles, perhaps from the British, perhaps from other countries, and maybe we will nevertheless come up with an amendment of the Rome II regulation that somehow improves this situation. Okay, that was the presentation, and I'm now open to questions.